What does a Mike Bloomberg candidacy mean for democracy?
Mike Bloomberg might get the Democratic nomination. He might win the presidency. That's the key word there being might. It could happen. We don't know because we've never seen this kind of move by an astronomically wealthy individual, right? We've never seen somebody this rich personally enter into the political process and take advantage of all of the vulnerabilities of that process.
That's John Nichols. We talk with him about his recent article for The Nation magazine, Democrats Must Reject Not Just a Billionaire, but the Billionaire Class. Then we switch gears to talk with novelist, biographer, and now short story writer Lucy Hughes Hallett about her new collection of stories based on myths and fables. It's called Fabulous. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Mike Bloomberg has an awful lot of money. By several calculations, he's either the 9th, 12th, or 14th richest person in the entire world. That kind of money has the gravitational pull of the sun. Journalists have reported that he's spending so much money on political consultants that there aren't enough of them left to work for down-ballot Democrats. In the February 25th CBS debate, Bloomberg caught himself while seeming to say that he had bought Democratic candidates in the 2018 election.
All of the new Democrats that came in and put Nancy Pelosi in charge and gave the Congress the ability to control this president, I got them.
Whatever he may have meant by that, it resonated across a social media universe because it confirmed what everybody knows. When you have that kind of money, the playing field is tilted your way. The ads that played in the breaks between debate segments were for Bloomberg, just part of the now nearly $500 million of pocket change he's spent on his campaign so far. But my guest John Nichols says we have to look beyond the candidate to examine the class he comes from. In his February 20th article for The Nation, for whom he's been covering the 2020 Democratic campaign, Nichols says Democrats must reject not just a billionaire, but the billionaire class. And he quotes Sanders in saying, the party cannot surrender to a corrupt political system bought by billionaires like Mr. Bloomberg. I called up John Nichols to find out more about why he thinks allowing billionaires to run for national office is such a threat. So you just wrote an article for The Nation, Democrats Must Reject Not Just a Billionaire, but the Billionaire Class. The subtitle is, Sanders is right that the party cannot surrender to a corrupt political system bought by billionaires like Mr. Bloomberg. Those are strong words. And as backup, you quote FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in 1936. Tell us what he said and what the context was.
The line, roughly paraphrased, is, we now know that rule by organized money is as dangerous as or as troubling as rule by organized mob. Now, he was speaking in the mid-1930s in 1936 at a time when Americans had a very deep understanding of what he was saying, the notion of an organized mob. And it was a time when there was a great deal of concern about organized crime, which was referred to as the mob. But also it was a time when there was a lot of mob violence, particularly in other countries, but somewhat in the U.S. as well. And so it was a scary thing. The term mob was something frightening. And Roosevelt wanted to communicate that it wasn't just something that a thug on the street might engage in, that wealth and power also organized. And when it organized in a way that might intimidate or threaten others, it might all be done by, you know, men in suits and ties and look rather, you know, proper. And yet it had a dramatically damaging and threatening impact on society and on governance. And he gave that speech as part of his 1936 reelection campaign. He was running against Alf Landon, who was the governor of Kansas. Now, Landon was thought of at that time as a very corporate, very conservative Republican. Today, he'd be a moderate to liberal Democrat because our politics has moved exponentially to the right in the United States. We've become politically, our range of political discourse is far more right-wing in a lot of ways than it was in the past. But in that context, Roosevelt was saying that there was an organized power in this country, not, again, just on the streets where it might play out with some sort of physical violence, but also in the suites, i.e., where bankers and corporate CEOs gathered. And that the point of his first term, Roosevelt, had been to counter this power, to bring a balance back to the American political dynamic. And what he was arguing was that in his 1936 reelection campaign, it was essential that he and Democrats who were supportive of him win that election so that they could finally temper that power, because they could finally create a fair balance in American politics. And he pointed out later in the speech that the bankers, the CEOs, the very wealthy people in the country were incredibly passionate about defeating him and saying really rough things about him. And his line was, "I welcome their hatred." It was an incredibly powerful message because he was essentially saying, "I'm ready to get in this fight. No more are we going to play the old game of Democrats and Republicans all being, you know, overly deferent to Wall Street and to economic power." Now, amazingly enough, in that campaign, when you could effectively say that Roosevelt threw the billionaires aside, or threw the very wealthy millionaires, because there weren't that many billionaires then, but threw the wealthy aside and said, "No, I want to forge a government that's on the other side of this equation," he won the most stunning victory in American politics, in the history of American politics. He won all but two states, Maine and Vermont. His percentages were astronomically high, and he swept in a Congress of Senate and a House of much more progressive Democrats. It wasn't all the way there. The Democratic Party still had a segregationist wing that was deeply troubling and problematic and actually often aligned with the Republicans. But the core of the Democratic Party had clearly moved to the left. And there were also independent left-wing parties that aligned with it. And so Roosevelt, after that 36 election, actually came with a mandate to reconcile American politics, to restructure it in a way that the Democratic Party would be the party of the great mass of people taking on concentrated wealth and power. The Republican Party would be the defenders of wealth and power. That's where it was. And amazingly enough, now 80 years later, 80 some years later, we find ourselves with the fight still going on in the Democratic Party. And literally people suggesting today, amazingly, almost unimaginably, that the saving grace, the way out for the Democratic Party might be a billionaire or even a group of billionaires funding a super PAC. And that's just, it's a fundamentally flawed concept, not merely within the Democratic Party, but for our politics.
Yeah, so spell that out. I think a lot of us can understand that there's something wrong with that kind of huge amount of political power, but specifically with Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
One of the dangers you feel he poses right now, not just to the Democratic Party, but also to the 2020 election and the ability for the Democrats to take back the White House.
Bloomberg might win. I think that's the important thing to say up front. Mike Bloomberg might get the Democratic nomination. He might win the presidency. That's the key word there being might. It could happen. We don't know because we've never seen this kind of move by an astronomically wealthy individual, right? We've never seen somebody this rich personally enter into the political process and take advantage of all of the vulnerabilities of that process.
And let's just say he is between the 12th or the 14th richest person in the world.
Yes, that's exactly right. He is about, you know, I mean, you see variously the amounts of money he has, and it's ranged from the mid 50 billions to the mid 60 billions. It could even be more. You know, the guy hasn't released his tax returns for this moment yet, and so we're still waiting to see, you know, what his bottom line is. But we know it's beyond the comprehension of the average American. It's also beyond the comprehension of traditional politics in the United States. we have a crisis in America. We spend too much money on elections. I want to emphasize that, put a circle around it. We spend too much money, and that's Democrats and Republicans. The more money that comes into a political process, the less likely it is to be tied to grassroots work, to people actually knocking on doors because they believe in a candidate, to, you know, all the sort of manifestations of democracy that you would want to see. Money is a democracy killing force. It limits it, it undermines it, it warps it. And so we've always had a problem. But now Bloomberg comes along and it's money on steroids. He's taken advantage of all of the openings that we allow for wealthy people to dominate our politics. And remember, wealthy people have dominated our politics. Our current president is a billionaire who took advantage not merely of his own wealth, the wealth of his supporters, but also the free media coverage to the wealthy, because our media is deferent to the wealthy, to become president of the United States. Now we have someone astronomically richer who frankly isn't as dynamic a personality as Trump, but he has so much more money he may possibly be able to buy his way into the game. We don't know. But what we do know is that if Bloomberg is nominated, if he were to be nominated, and then were to lose to Trump, right, that would tell us something about the limits of money in politics. And maybe to some extent, some people might see that as a good thing, but what they'll lose sight of is the fact that Trump is himself raising astronomical amounts of money from the very wealthy. And so you would end up, if Bloomberg's nominated, whether he wins or loses, it's a billionaire versus billionaire, big money versus big money campaign that goes in exactly the wrong direction. And to the extent that there's mobilization, and there might be mobilization on both the Republican and the Democratic side, it is a manipulated and managed and financed mobilization as opposed to something genuine, right? Something that really does come from the grassroots and is people, you know, organizing because they want to achieve something to the good. And so you've got a problem there right off the bat. And that's where I talk about this notion of, you know, you ought to reject not just the billionaire, but the billionaire class, because there's too much of a focus on personalities here. Mike Bloomberg is a very flawed individual, as Elizabeth Warren, I thought, very effectively pointed out in the debate. However, if he wasn't so flawed, right, if he was a better person, if he had a better record, that wouldn't in any way calm my concerns, because you still have a situation where a very wealthy person is able to buy their way onto a debate stage, perhaps by a nomination, perhaps by the presidency. That's what's fundamentally unhealthy. And so while I really appreciated Elizabeth Warren's critique of Bloomberg in the debate and thought it was extremely important because she took him apart as an individual, I also appreciated Bernie Sanders' critique in the debate because he took Bloomberg apart as part of a class of billionaires and what that threat poses. I think both Warren and Sanders understand this threat, and I respect them both for the different sides of it they took on. And that's why I wrote about it in the way that I did, you know, highlighting some substantial elements of what Warren had to say about Bloomberg, but also highlighting some substantial elements of what Sanders had to say.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with John Nichols of The Nation about his recent article, Democrats Must Reject Not Just a Billionaire, But the Billionaire Class. Now, one of the things that Bernie says is that billionaires should not exist, and I'm not so sure that he really explains why very well, and I wonder if you could take a crack at that.
Well, I thought in the debate he gave a little bit of an explanation, but it was interesting because it did lead to the fascinating moment where I think it was Chuck Todd asked Mike Bloomberg, should you exist? And I thought, you know, if we've gotten to that point, we've already begun to have a more interesting debate than we'd had at any time in the past. So more power to Chuck Todd for asking that question, more power to Bernie Sanders for putting this notion in the mix. But no, I don't think they really explored it in a thorough way. Here's the core of what Sanders said in the debate, and I think, you know, more generally what he's been saying, is that when you can concentrate that much wealth, you know, when you can literally take in that much wealth, there's something flawed in the system. And so it's not, I'm not speaking for him. He may have a different or better take on it. But stepping back from what Sanders has said. What I would suggest is it's this, that it's not against an individual. It's not, you know, like Mike Bloomberg or Donald Trump or name 10 other billionaires, right? It's not that. It's the notion that you have a system that allows for such massive concentration of wealth. And if you were to say as a country, look, you know, it's okay, which I, that's, you know, I still think it's pretty extreme. You say it's okay if you get 999,999,999, right? You know, if you get, you know, one step below a billion, you know, we'll deal with that once we've dealt with it. But if you go over a billion, that maybe should send up a red flag, right? That if people can start accumulating at that level of wealth, two things happen. Number one, you know, they can't spend it all, right? And even if they're very charitable, it's all kind of done by them. So you're really locking up a lot of the wealth of the country in a small group of individuals. But number two, what we know from economics is that when somebody has a billion, they're very likely to get another billion and another billion after that because they have such exponential buying power, if you will, as regards the growth of their wealth. And so the alarm bell goes up and we start to debate about whether that's a healthy system. And interestingly enough, we're having that debate as regards tech companies, right? Should tech companies be as big as they are? Should they accumulate as much wealth as they do? And even the Congress of the United States is sort of, you know, tentatively exploring some of these issues. And the reason we explore it, interestingly enough, or I would argue, is not because of the wealth, right? It's not that somebody's really, really rich and, you know, buys glamorous houses or has, you know, all these benefits and advantages. And it is that with wealth goes power, and with wealth goes the ability to buy power. And this is the where the great challenge comes, why we ought to be concerned about it. Again, not about the individual, not about the even the class of individuals, just because, you know, it might be offensive to some people to see such concentrated wealth. It's really about that linkage of wealth and power. And what Bloomberg is showing us is the kind of next play out of it. The first play out's already occurred, right? Billionaires buy their way into politics all the time, but they usually do it by creating super PACs or by donating massively to the candidates they like. Now you end up with a next stage of this, which is the billionaire actually stepping through the looking glass, if you will, and asserting himself or herself, in this case, usually a him, at the center of our politics as a candidate. And the last thing I'll say about this, which is perhaps the most important thing, is our political rules and regulations are designed to empower the billionaire. And it isn't just that a billionaire can spend whatever they want to help build up a super PAC or something like that. It is that the way that our rules are designed, going back to the mid-1970s with the Buckley v. Vallejo decision, is that a candidate can spend whatever they want on their own campaign, right? So the last barriers to buying something go away if you as a billionaire are the candidate. It's as if, you know, historically a wealthy person could drive in the nicest limousine possible, right? But they still had to stop for the stoplights. If you are a wealthy candidate, all the stoplights go green. You not only are in your limousine, you can go as fast as you want without ever getting slowed down. And so this is kind of the ultimate play out of the challenge. And it is about the billionaire to some extent. It's about the billionaire class to some extent. But it is really about the linkage of the billionaire and the billionaire class to power and the pursuit of power. And that's what we're talking about right now.
Right. Now, we started out talking today about FDR, and you pointed out the landslide victory he had. It wasn't the only one. He was reelected four times. He was hugely popular and really set the conditions in the United States that post-war led to the most equal society we've ever had as a nation and one of the greatest prosperity of the middle class. He was eminently electable. So I wonder if you think that Sanders is in a moment and reflects a moment when someone who has his politics, FDR politics, he calls himself a democratic socialist, but really he's a social democrat, just like FDR, those politics can also really beat the power of the billionaire class with the kind of movement that he's building.
Well, so my answer to your question is the only honest answer anybody can give at this point in our history. I don't know. Because we shall see, right? Wealth and power is incredibly concentrated at this point and incredibly powerful. Our media is less diverse, and that's an important thing to understand. While we have social media, which does bring many, many more voices in a lot of ways, the organized media of the country has become far more consolidated, far more concentrated, and frankly, far more drab and you know, kind of center-right in its personality and its character. So a lot of things have changed from the 1930s, as we know. Also, the thing is, we are currently in a relatively strong economic cycle, whereas in the 1930s, people really were struggling with a Great Depression, and that is a fundamental defining characteristic of a circumstance. And so we have to accept that things are different. We also have to accept a couple other things. Franklin Roosevelt was different than Bernie Sanders. He was much younger, even though his health was not Roosevelt's health was not particularly great. Another thing is the Republican Party was different. It was not as right-wing as it is today, and not as extreme as it is today. The Democratic Party was different. It was a amalgam of big city machines, Southern segregationists, and reformers and more progressive figures, especially growing union movement. So you put all these things in the mix. I think the comparisons you have to be a little cautious about. But if we then step back from that, and say that because of the incredible concentration of wealth at this point, and because of the fact that even when the economy is doing well, people feel very ill at ease because the cost of living has become more and more extreme, especially in our urban areas where renting an apartment or buying a house has become prohibitive for working class people and all sorts of other factors. You end up in a situation where we still have sort of an austerity in the midst of an economic supposed economic boom. And so there's a lot of tension out there. There's a lot of discomfort. There is clearly a lot of discomfort among younger voters and a rising generation of voters. So when we get to your core question, could Sanders build a coalition that might take the Democratic nomination and then potentially beat Donald Trump? I say yes. I say that is possible. And the way that that becomes possible, of course, is to build on the base of the Democratic Party that is there. You got about 47% of people that are probably going to vote for anybody against Trump. Then expand it out exponentially. Find massive numbers of disenfranchised voters, disenchanted voters, a few swing voters, because there are some. And then supercharge it with a youth turnout that it's pretty arguable Sanders alone, although I might be wrong. You know, maybe another candidate generates it, but Sanders seems to have a really distinctive ability to engage and turn out younger voters. If you welded that all together into a 2020 campaign and it delivered for Sanders, it is very likely that it would deliver for the rest of a Democratic ticket. People would get the point there. And then, yeah, might you get, you know, one of those transformational elections that an awful lot of our pundit class always tells us is impossible, but then they happen. Yeah, it is possible. The important thing to understand is these moments come in times of uncertainty, in times of discomfort, and, you know, frankly, some fear about the future. Roosevelt famously said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And interestingly enough, he achieved in 1932 his initial election, a massive breakthrough. 36, he was reelected overwhelmingly, 40 and 44 as well, striking. And each time as he went along the way, what was Franklin Roosevelt talking about? You know, I welcome their hatred. Then in, you know, the early 1940s, talking about a four freedoms vision for the world, i.e., you know, really spreading a much deeper democracy and a freedom not merely from oppression, but also a freedom from want. And then in the later stages of his politics, talking about an economic bill of rights, i.e. extending the basic rights of the country, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, et cetera, freedom from, you know, unfair prosecutions, to a next stage that, you know, freedom from want in a fundamental way, i.e. work, health, sustainable old age, you know, all of these things coming together in a way that might make for a social democracy, you know, or something along that those terms. And as Roosevelt did this, as he kept extending it, he did better and better. So that, in a moment, a turbulent moment, Roosevelt presented a vision that a tremendous number of people attached to. Roosevelt was imperfect, a flawed man in many, many ways, and it's important to understand that. You know, you don't have to make him into a perfect hero. And once we've said that, then let us also understand that the next transformational election that was, you know, really deeply transformational was 1964, when Lyndon Johnson won a overwhelming majority in the aftermath of the assassination of John Kennedy. And that overwhelming majority, look what happened in that brief period there. Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, the war on poverty, the launch of public broadcasting. You know, you just run down the list. It's amazing what occurs when you actually get, you know, that kind of position, that kind of power. Okay. And then the last one I'll reference, again, LBJ being a flawed guy, but the moment, correct. Ronald Reagan, 1980. And we need to understand that Ronald Reagan's victory was in many ways, as transformational as Franklin Roosevelt's. Very different men. I would argue Reagan, an incredibly flawed guy, but he got that moment. He got that majority as a presidential candidate, but also flipping the Senate and getting enough action, enough movement in the House to actually really change the direction of the country and our politics in all sorts of ways. So these things happen. They are possible. They do occur. They are never measured in the moment, right? You have to then see if it extends and goes forward. And I guess that the fairest way to analyze it is to say that this is what Sanders talks about when he refers to a political revolution.
Exactly. Well, that is just a fascinating analysis of the current situation rooted in the past. And, you know, we should point out that Sanders has referenced those four freedoms of FDR and very much has talked about completing the promise of FDR's presidency. John Nichols, thank you so much. As always, it has just been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for coming on to Writer's Voice.
It's a total pleasure to be on with you. And I've got a new book coming out soon about all these issues, and I hope to come back and chat with you.
Yes. In fact, we intend to have you back on. When will that be published?
I think it'll be in the spring. It's called The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. And it's really, it does examine a lot of these fundamental questions of the wrestling within the Democratic Party over its present and its future.
Can't wait to talk with you about that book.
Thank you so much.
John Nichols. Go to writersvoice.net to find links to his recent article and to other articles of his as he continues to cover the Democratic presidential campaign for The Nation magazine. Next up, stories based on the myths and fables of old, updated to modern London. We talk with Lucy Hughes Hallett about Fabulous. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. It's in the nature of myths and fables to be infinitely adaptable. That principle has given literary license to my guest, Lucy Hughes Hallett, in her new collection of short stories, Fabulous. Based on ancient myth, folk fables, and Bible stories, the tales in her book extract surprising meanings from the originals to make keen observations about our time. Their characters include a people-trafficking gangmaster and a prostitute, a migrant worker and an arrogant realtor, an elderly musician befuddled by dementia and the death of his wife, and more. These witty fables are set in modern London, but they're also explorations of the mysteries and passions of their originals. Lucy Hughes Hallett is the author of several biographies, including one of Gabrielle D'Annunzio and of Cleopatra, and also the author of the novel Peculiar Ground, about which we spoke with her in a previous episode of Writer's Voice. Well, Lucy Hughes Hallett, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for inviting me back.
So we last talked with you about your novel, Peculiar Ground. This is quite a different book, fabulous. This is a collection of stories based on the stories of classics, a Bible story, also the fable of the Pied Piper. What drew you to retelling these classic myths, fables, and the Bible story?
Well, there's a reason, obviously, why these stories have lasted for centuries or millennia in most cases. They're very resonant. They have a kind of fluidity which allows them to be infinitely adapted in an infinite number of ways. So each of the stories I've used here has, it might have been turned into opera or ballet, poems written about it, it's inspired painters, songs sung. You can play with these stories any which way you want to, and that's fun, that's exciting. And the stories I chose to focus on, of course, there's a vast number of fables I could have chosen rather than these particular ones, but the ones I picked on, they're all stories which seem to me slightly baffling, that have something unexplained in their core. And retelling the story in each case was a way of thinking about that, of exploring the mystery, the perhaps obscure, contradictory, puzzling aspects of those fables.
Yeah, and you picked some of my favorites, starting with Orpheus. You know, and you give a brief explanation at the back of the book of, you know, what is the classic tale that you're riffing on. Of course, Orpheus was the musician whose wife died, went down to the underworld, and he went after her to find her and to bring her back with his music, losing her forever when he looked back. But in this one, this is about a couple. And actually, I wanted to ask you, because in the publicity material I received, it said that this is an elderly couple where death and dementia encroach, but that's not actually what I got. I didn't really have a sense of what the age was, although I knew that these were not youngsters. Tell us about your retelling of the story of Orpheus.
Well, indeed, the story of Orpheus is a good example of what I was talking about earlier. The mystery, the problem, the kind of the little grit which in the oyster, which stimulates the oyster to produce the pearl, is that there seems to be something very unfair about this. So Orpheus goes down into the underworld to rescue his wife who has died, and the king and queen of the underworld tell him that he can take her back to the world of the living as long as on their journey back from darkness up into light, he never looks round. And the story is heartbreaking in most of the tellings of it. Eurydice is going along behind him. She doesn't understand what's going on. She's going, why won't you look at me? Don't you love me anymore? Why are you so cold? Why are you so distant? And he can't tell her. And eventually he gives in, he turns around. I give him a slightly different motive for the turning around, which is that he's vulnerable. And I'm interested that you don't see these people as being of any particular age. And I'm rather pleased about that because I don't want it to be ever too specific. But I was certainly seeing them as a couple who've been together a long time and are mutually dependent, and he especially, and this is often true of men whose partners die first, feel very hopeless and helpless and lost on their own, and can't cope with a single life after many years of, you know, having a wife they could turn to. And Orpheus, or Oz, as I call him, is one of those rather lost men who can't cope alone. And it's his inability to just stride ahead without looking round, which makes it impossible for him not to look back at his Eurydice. And therefore, he loses her. And I was certainly, in writing this story, I was thinking of in relatives of an older generation who have succumbed to dementia and who became rather childlike almost in their old age, even if they might have been very dominant people in their, you know, in their prime, in their middle age. And so I wanted to put some of that pathos into this story.
Pathos, that's a good word. You know, the sense that in spite of our dearest desires, that we cannot help being ruled in some way by our limitations.
Yes. Yes, there's a vulnerability in this story and in most of them, I think. I think that what the ancient peoples who came up with these stories in the first place were often dealing with things which felt to them, when I say things, I mean relationships, circumstances of the world around them, which were difficult and painful for them and for which they couldn't find explanations. And I think for the people who first told these stories, as for me, a way of kind of thinking around these problems is simply to tell the story and to find which way of telling it feels resonant and right to us.
And of course, you're bringing them into our contemporary world. Although you said in the beginning that each one of these, the original stories, you know, has something that is, you know, a kind of a mystery at the heart of it. I feel that that's true for the stories as you retell them as well. I mean, they're not exactly, you know, they don't lay things out in black and white. The reader has to puzzle through them.
Yeah, I like to keep a bit of mystery. And because these are, that they're fables, they're not social realism, these stories, every now and then something happens which is supernatural.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist and short story writer Lucy Hughes Hallett about her latest book. It's a collection of stories based on myth and Bible stories and fables. It's called Fabulous. Yeah, now the story of Actaeon, probably most, you know, I'm pretty up on the fables because I was raised on them, on the myths, but I had to look this one up. This is the story of a hunter who gets into trouble with Diana, the goddess of the hunt. In this case, you apply this story to the ruthlessness of the real estate market in London. Tell us a little bit about the story and what you were exploring in it.
Yeah, it was great fun to write that one. Actually, it was fun to write all of them because, as you say, I bring them up into the modern world. Some of them are set in a time and place which isn't quite so clearly defined, but certainly my version of Actaeon is absolutely London right now. And we're in the middle of a property, not a boom, it may be a bust, but a time when the property market is terrifically important in everyone's lives, everyone who lives in this city. And the vast inflation in property prices has been something that's shaped my experience and that of anyone else who's lived in London over the past few decades. And I'm interested in estate agents, as we call them. I think you call them real estate. What do you call them?
Real estate agents.
Yeah. Real estate agents, same thing. And actually, I've sometimes thought that if I wasn't a writer, I'd rather like to do that job because I love poking around in other people's houses and seeing how other people live and the choices they make about, you know, just how they're going to construct space around them and how they decorate it. I'm inquisitive. I like that. And when I say that, people often look a bit shocked because real estate agents are seen as being kind of pretty rapacious people. They're very unpopular, probably rather unfairly, but of course, you know, they're there to make money out of people. So I thought it would be fun just to look at a group of people who are working in that market. They're all colleagues. They kind of, as it were, hunt together. And then impose on this group of people this very, very ancient myth, which of course has an enormous amount of modern resonance. And it's a story about a man who trespasses into female space. He sees the goddess Diana, or Artemis in Greek, bathing with her nymphs in a forest pool. And he spies on her. He watches the goddess naked, and she's extremely angry. So there's a kind of a sexual transgression there, which absolutely resonates with what's going on in the world around us. So it was very easy to transpose it. And then it became rather fun. This is a first-person narrator. They aren't all, but I chose the narrator to be not the Actium character, but another estate agent who's has his own insecurities and very questionable sexual practices, which we only gradually become aware of. And so if you have a first-person narrator, obviously you're getting the story filtered through that person's consciousness. And so I was able to play a lot of games with the kind of the different moral angles on the story I'm telling. You know, has Actian, or Acton, as I call him. I fiddle around with the names a bit, modernize them, anglicize them. Acton has maybe done something reprehensible, or maybe from the point of view of the male narrator, it's all just, you know, boys together, a load of laughs. And so I was able to introduce a lot of layers of perception into this fairly simple story.
Yeah, and even with the narrator, he goes through a transformation. I mean, when you, in the eye of the reader, I know when it started out, you know, he seemed like a rather colorless, maybe timid guy. But by the end, he's being used as an instrument of revenge by this his boss, Diana. Say a little bit about that shift.
Yeah, well, it's quite a nasty story in all sorts of ways, as some of these ancient stories are. And it's an odd thing that conventionally the fables from classical mythology, Bible stories, fairy tales are given to children to read, but they tend to be pretty dark, actually. You know, they're dealing with the violent, the sexual, the frightened parts of the human psyche. And in this story, I'm looking at that. And one of the things I'm looking at is the kind of pack mentality, because in the ancient versions of the story, Actian is a human huntsman who's gone out hunting with his hounds. In my story, there are a whole load of humans hunting together. And rather than Actian being transformed into a stag and then destroyed by his own hounds, which is what happens in the classical myth, it's the other guys and women as well who are transformed into hounds, having started off human. And then I end with the image of these sort of creatures who are by this time dogs exercising along the embankment of the Thames in their lunch hour. And this is something that any visitor to London recently will have seen, that in the lunch hour, along both sides of the Thames, there are loads and loads of office workers who come out. In the olden days, office workers used to go off and have a big meal and perhaps a drink at lunchtime. Nowadays, they put on lycra and they go running along the river. And it's a very funny sight because they do run in packs.
Well, that's quite an image that you just called up. Now, Let's move to the Bible story. This is the story of, well, actually, there are two of them. There's one of Joseph, and the other one is Mary Magdalene. But the Joseph one I found very poignant and actually sad by the end of it. You know, quite a different feeling to the Bible story itself. Tell us, why did you pick this one, you know, this story to retell in the way you told it?
Yes, it is a sad story. Obviously, as you know, once you've read the story, your listeners will know that it is a story about migration, about immigrants, illegal immigrants making a living, however they can manage it, which is something which is, you know, it's a very dominant theme of British public life at the moment, and I think probably anywhere in the world. And people are now on the move, and it's not always easy to get regular employment when you fetch up in a new country. And so my Joseph, like the original Joseph, actually, you know, the Joseph in the Bible has to leave Nazareth, and, no, sorry, leave Bethlehem and go and make a living in Nazareth as a carpenter. And my Joseph is from somewhere, I don't specify where he's from actually, but Eastern Europe. And he fetches up in England, where he manages to get casual work initially as a window cleaner and then later doing other jobs. And that is a pretty precarious situation for anyone to be in. And, you know, one sees it all around in the modern world. And I wanted to put into this story something of what I feel and think about these people who are, you know, making a very hand-to-mouth living in our great modern prosperous cities. But also, I do think the story of Joseph, it's one of those stories where in the old versions, there's a bit of a mystery. Mm. You know, when the story of Christ's nativity is told, it's all joyful and angels singing hallelujah. But there is this unexplored presence, which is Joseph, who's going to take in this baby. He's not its father. He doesn't know who the father is. Mary's told him that it's God's child. Well, how's he to understand that? And so I thought that, you know, there's potential there for comedy, a rather sort of wistful kind of comedy, but also for real pain.
Yes, it really was. And, well, even you're right, the original story, it's so funny that when you read a retelling or modern retelling a story, how it makes you re-examine the original story. Because I have actually never questioned why this figure of Joseph, you know, why in such a patriarchal culture as the ancient Near East did he, you know, just so blithely adopt the son of his wife?
Yes. Well, as I say, I think that what makes these stories endlessly fascinating is that they all contain something which isn't neatly tied up, which isn't resolved, which, as it were, allows a kind of a crack in the pavement out of which things can grow, which gave me an opportunity to write stories which are, although based on very ancient material, are actually new.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist and now short story writer Lucy Hughes Hallett about her collection of stories. It's called Fabulous. I wanted to ask you about Psyche, because this was one story. Now, of course, we know the word psyche as soul or the internal, you know, emotional state of a person. But I reread the original story, which is quite different than the one that in fact, the original story is quite terrible. This one is I have to say it was a kind of strange story where something that you think that is going to be terrible happens and it isn't terrible. And there was much more of a mystery to your psyche, a story, than there is to the original, where psyche has, you know, she upsets it's Aphrodite, right? Is set all kinds of terrible tasks to do, and she's helped out by the gods, and everything ends happily ever after. But doesn't do that in your story.
No, I rather like doing the thing that you've remarked on, which is sort of setting up a particular kind of story so that the reader will be waiting for a particular kind of outcome and then actually swerving off in a different direction. And I did that repeatedly in my novel In Peculiar Ground, where particularly around a character called Anthony, who is gay and who is a spy. And he's spying, this is set in the early 1960s, that part of the narrative. And he's spying for the Russians. And so if you have a gay man who's not out, and you have a man who's spying for what would have been perceived as the enemy by most British people in the 1960s, it's like you're setting up two particular kinds of story. You know, one is, it's a spy story. Oh my goodness, Anthony's a spy. Trigger, you know, James Bond and car chases and guns and that kind of excitement. Or, oh my goodness, Anthony's gay. And then in that, you know, half a century ago, that would lead to a lot of anxiety probably for himself and his friends. But actually in both cases, I had, as these revelations come one after another, I had Anthony being the person who was surprised to find that all of his friends knew both his secrets already. They'd guessed years ago and they couldn't give a toss. And so, you know, there was no need for a car chase or a dramatic revelation. It was called, yeah, of course, we knew that. And that, I think, is quite fun to do and also true to real life. Because, you know, in writing fiction, even in using these very sort of traditional stories, I wanted to get away from literary convention and to mimic the way human emotion really works.
Which is kind of often muddied.
Exactly. Yes. And the psyche story was a fun one to choose. And I make my psyche, the female character, a very poised, very confident figure. And in the, you know, the ancient tellings of the story, she's comparatively vulnerable and she's being beset by the goddess of love, Venus, and her son, Cupid. And so, you know, it's Psyche who's the victim who's being manipulated. And it seemed fun to actually say, no, here's a very self-confident young woman, and here's a cherubic little Cupid-like figure who wants to carry her off. And she takes this in her stride and thinks she could get some pleasure out of it. And it was fun to turn that around. But as you point out, I mean, this is a story about a young woman being physically assaulted by a group of young men. It's a rather nasty story. And as I say, these fables, they're not pretty. They're dealing with some quite difficult, contentious subject matter.
That's so true. And just a final question now. Is this the first collection of short stories that you've written?
It is. And I tend to write very, very long books. So I've written three works of nonfiction and my novel Peculiar Ground, and you know, they're all socking great fat books. And it was very enjoyable to write these very short pieces. So even the collection, it's not a doorstop of a book. And of course it contains eight stories, each of them you could, you know, read in a rather long lunch hour. long train ride, let's say. And just to write in that very concentrated way, to write something that's sort of tiny and compressed, was very exciting. I like each of my books to be completely different from the one that went before, which is part of the reason why it was such fun to switch to fiction, kind of having spent a long time writing historical biography or cultural history. And so writing these little stories, which have to be kind of, you know, gem-like, polished, everything, every word is working really hard. You can't do on the one hand or on the other. You can't digress. You have to stay absolutely tight when you're writing pieces as concentrated as this. And that was thrilling, actually. It was very exciting to work. I mean, it's like, you know, having trained as a marathon runner and then suddenly just doing a quick sprint.
Mm. So is a play in the offing next?
Yeah, that ought to be the next thing, shouldn't it? But actually, no, I'm going back to what I've done before. And I'm just beginning work on a book about the first Duke of Buckingham, who was King James I's lover and first minister. And I say a book rather than a biography because I haven't quite worked out what my structure is going to be, how to use this story. But it's a story about someone who started off with really no assets apart from his extraordinary beauty. And when he was very young, he was brought to court as a piece of sexual bait to entice the king. That worked, the king fell for him, and so he very quickly became very rich, very powerful, and then his downfall was that having enjoyed beauty, wealth and power, he then went after glory as well and started a completely unnecessary war and got killed indirectly as a result of that. So it's a story full of examples.
Yes, I look forward to talking with you about that one when it's done. And Lucy Hughes Hallett, your latest work is a work of short stories. Fabulous. It's just been such a pleasure to talk with you about this book.
Thank you, Francesca. I've enjoyed this conversation.
Lucy Hughes Hallett. Read an excerpt from Fabulous by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.